It's happy hour time. Welcome to my show. I'm your host, Simon Ngo. I'm a lifestyle and wellness coach, and one of the things that I love to do is to drop some truth bombs. Some of the ugly ones, some of the touching ones, some funny ones. Most importantly, these are just all reminders on how to live out of your own bullshit and more into realness so that you can lead your pathway to find more happiness in your own life. Hi guys, welcome back to my pod, the Happy Hour podcast. So we have missed a couple of weeks just because I was sick. I caught the winter cold and I just wasn't in any position to produce any episodes that includes the recording, the editing, and the publishing of the episodes to the world wide web. So that's the only reason why there hasn't been any. And after that, I had to go away to do some training, which I wasn't in a position to bring my recording device along because the training was from the morning. It's an all-day training for 3 days in a row. So here we are back at the Happy Hour podcast. So a lot of people have actually asked, why did I decide to name it the Happy Hour podcast? Well, I had the vision where it is almost like a catch-up with me. And I think even with our friends in our circle, like the times that people usually catch up are when it's happy hour, whether it's happy hour at the bar where you get two beers for the price of one, whether it's catching up happy hour at high tea over a kombucha or whatever it is. So even right now, I'm actually sipping a cup of tea. T2 French Earl Grey that my best friend bought for me for my birthday this year. So yeah, think about this podcast as just our regular hangs, a conversation with Simon while we talk about some tips, some tricks, some truth bombs so that we could face our life and become happier, hopefully. So in this episode, we're actually going to talk about the five things that people actually don't know about me. It's going to be quite a revealing episode. It's going to be an episode where I have to pull back my mask and just let myself be vulnerable and accessible to the world. Cool. So here we go. There are five things that people don't know, and out of this five things that people don't know, or things that I've been hiding really well my entire life, there are also lessons that came along with it. There are also things that I've picked up, things that I've learned about myself, and yeah, and now I'm coping better, or I am totally out of the negative cycle, so to speak. So let's crack on and dive straight into it. Number one, I was once actually depressed. Yeah, when I was in high school, even university years, I was actually, I had depression in the sense that I wasn't depressed where people could see me that I was depressed. I think in light of like two celebrities who have taken their own life, we have Kate Spade and we had Anthony Bourdain in the last few weeks that have just passed. And I think depression is such a thing where it has no form, you know. People can't tell if you have depression, and people cannot tell if you are going through a hard time and you're just really good at hiding your emotions. And that was me certainly when I was going through high school and when I was going through university. And which is why I was such a go-getter, which is why I wanted to keep myself busy, because I hated the idea of slowing down. I hated the idea of not doing things and just fully retreating to rest and restore, fully retreating back to enjoying being in the moment, because I didn't know how to. And I remember in uni, I would always tell some of my closer friends that I, like, in a joking fashion, and just go, you know, I can't have a day off, or, like, you know, I don't have a weekend where I don't do things because I suffer from weekend depression. And I guess that was like me jokingly admitting to the world, or confessing to the world, or even almost shouting to the world that, hey, I've got depression, do something about it, help me. I guess that was my call out for help. But because back then, I guess depression was never really a sexy thing. Like, mental health isn't really a sexy thing to talk about even till today. So, you know, and being a person who has been high performing his entire life, who's been a go-getter, people just don't think that you are depressed or you have depression. And I remember I hated the idea of not doing stuff because I was afraid. And it's always when I slow down that it's almost like a whole dark cloud just swooping over my head, and everything will be dark, emotions would be down, motivations would be low, energy levels would be low, and it was just sucky. Like, it was just gloomy, dark, cold, empty. Yeah, and I guess it was the emptiness that I was really afraid of. So because of that, like, I kept myself moving, I kept myself busy, working hard, hustling, because it's the only way I knew how to cope with my life back then. And it was a temporary escape, because when the working stopped, when the when everything else is stopping, then I have nothing. And I remember I try to, not that I didn't, like, I try to be comfortable in my own company and stop being, I guess, like, needing to be in a social setting and just give myself the permission to enjoy my own company. But I would just, for example, watch a TV show and just randomly burst out crying for no reason. And I think that was just a lot of, whether it's like mental scars or mental trauma from my upbringing that I've been keeping to myself and not knowing how to express them, or ashamed to let the world know that was my upbringing. I think as a human, as a person, you can only keep things to yourself for so long. You can only keep carrying the baggage for so long, and until one day you would just break down. And let me tell you, it's ugly when things do break down, because everything that we do is just a band-aid, you know. It's just a band-aid that we apply. It's temporary, it's just an escape, but we never really learn to figure it out what was actually wrong underneath. And for me, I think a lot of it had to do with my Asian upbringing. And in our family, you know, we don't really say things like I love you. No, we don't. It's just, maybe it's just a thing in my family, maybe it's an Asian thing, but I think most likely it's an Asian thing. Like, you see a lot of like, I love yous, perhaps, on, like, TV shows, in Asian drama series. But again, like, when they say I love you, it's more likely between lovers. So, like, girlfriend, boyfriends expressing, you know, I love you. It's never, or it's very uncommon, I should say, that it's within, like family members. Like, it's definitely something that you won't say, or you would say to your sibling or your parents, or from your parents to you. It's kind of like you don't say it, you just show it. And the way you show it in the Asian way of doing things is you give them tough love. Like, that's the only love that we know how. It's tough love. Like, we critique our, you know, family members harsher than we critique anybody else. And it's always been like that. And I remember the competitiveness between my family and our extended family, so our relatives. It's like an ongoing thing. Like, you constantly compare, you constantly try to outshine the relatives. It's like, for example, conversations from, like, perhaps like my mom with one of my aunties would be like, so my son or my daughter has achieved this, so what is your son and what's your daughter up to these days? So it's like the forever comparison, and there is no break from that. It's like, this is your new target, go get it. And never have I had an experience where my parents would tell me, well done, good work, that was amazing, that was brilliant. It was, yeah, there was never anything like that. It was just more pushing you upwards from below. And by that I mean, the tone of the conversations would be like, so-and-so has already bought a car, what about you, when are you gonna get a car? So-and-so has already bought an apartment, their first home, what about you, when are you gonna get a home? So-and-so has done this, has done that, what about you? So like where is your success? So it's a very tough love from our parents and in my upbringing. And I think from that, there was a lot of, I guess, internalizing all these years of tough love and not knowing how to express the noise, how to express enough. I need a break from you all hovering over me, you know, the helicopter parenting, like the tiger mom parenting type. I need space, I need air. I guess there was just never such thing, because in Asian families, just like, even just voicing that out to your parents, as they say, you know, why are you speaking back to your elders? That is rude, and that is just unacceptable. So you don't. So you never, you just say yes, or you just do it and you show the products, and that's how things work. And I think, which is why I became not very good in asking for help. I'm not very good in retreating. I'm not very good in giving up. I'm not very good in, I'm just not very good in saying, no, I can't do this, I need more time, or I don't know how to do this, I need someone to help me, I don't know how to get through things, I need help. So you don't. So you just carry every single emotions, hardships, tough moments on your own, and at times it becomes really lonely and it becomes really hard to deal with things. And I think that's where the depression stemmed from. So it's like when you finally have a chance to only be in your own company, and everything just bubbles to the surface, and you're like, I wish someone would understand that I need some space. I wish someone would understand that I, yeah. So then you don't, and then you just keep charging on, and you go on to this pathway of burnout. You go towards this pathway of mental breakdown. So that was one of the things that people don't know about me. And I'm very lucky. I think I am so lucky because I have this really tough Asian upbringing, and it's also not very common. It's not very it's not a very traditional Asian thing to do, for your parents to split up. And I think my parents did just that. So I think we are the only broken or the only unsuccessful family in the whole extended family. Yeah. Talk about standing out, hey, from the first episode where we talk about, you know, why blend in when you can stand out. I guess I have been standing out my whole entire life and I didn't even know it. Yeah, so there was that. And I think from, and then you become like the odd one in the extended family. It's like as a child, as a teenager, you would go, your cousins have a dad and a mom, and everyone lives under one roof, but not in my family. And I think that's probably a big enough chapter to have its own episode. So that's just a little bit of background. But from there, we also don't give a lot of praises. Like I said before, it's only the tough love, like shoving you towards success, but never really praising. Yeah, there was no such thing as good job, well done, I'm so proud of you, I love that you got this, whatever. And yeah, it was just do it, just go and make shit happen. And I think that's why I've turned out to be who I am today. And I'm very lucky that I went through this episode of depression. And for me, that is probably also why that I'm less sensitive to the people around me. I remember one of my bosses who I was working with when I was still working in the fitness industry as a manager. We've known each other for a little while, and I think he was quite looking forward to working together because we'll be in the same club. And then I didn't even realize until he mentioned it to me. He pulled me aside for, you know, for a lunch catch up, and then he was saying, how did you realize that sometimes you can be just doing your own thing and you're not really supporting the whole team? So it's almost like I automatically just expect everyone to be as tough as a go-getter and as resilient as myself. And then I just, you know, becoming very tunnel vision. And I remember I didn't even know, because I was unaware. And he was saying how, you know, I would just come in and just make sure my own department is shining, is doing the best that it can do, which is great. But when your department is sorted and your colleagues need a little bit more love, whether that's just nurture or support or a little bit of kick in the bum to get them moving towards their targets, I wasn't there. I wasn't there to be the support figure. I wasn't there to, I guess, show any sympathy, empathy, or support. So, yeah, and that really hit home. And then, but I didn't mind it. I didn't mind people telling me the truth, which is, I guess, part of the reasons why I wanted to create this podcast, you know, even though it's just a conversation between me and a virtual audience. I feel like, and the reason why I wanted to talk about some truths is because sometimes the biggest lessons in life happen when someone tells it to you and you're not ready to listen. And I wasn't ready to hear that because I didn't know. But then when it was told straight to my face, I was like, yeah, actually, that is true. And now that you're aware, you have two choices, you know. You can take it or you can dump it. And then when you take it, are you going to do something about it or not? So essentially now the onus is back on us. How am I going to present myself in front of other people? How do I want to be perceived by other people? And I think that is important. Yeah. Because if I wanted to break out of the mold of, or break out of that depressive patterns, and I wanted to fit in and I wanted to belong to a community and I wanted to be accepted by this team, that's exactly what I needed to do. So that there is that two-way communication, so that when I do something well and they say great work and they praise me, they show me the love, I'm not going to be awkward about it. And then at the same token, when they need help, I'll be there to support. When they're doing well, I will be there to be saying, hey, well done, good on you, that was amazing. Because I knew what it felt like for your efforts, your struggle, and your tough times to not be acknowledged or recognized by the most important people in your life, and that is your family. And that was the one thing that I had to go through in my upbringing, especially in the tougher high school and university times. Not many people know. I think I very luckily channeled my depressive thoughts and emotions towards something more productive, thankfully, and rather than something more negative. And I remember when in high school and you go through so I did part of my high school years in Malaysia, and over there is a whole heap of co-curriculum, extracurriculum activities or competitions, because they wanted to, I guess, want students to not only be book smart, but also street smart with, you know, life skills. So I was very fortunate enough to participate in public speaking, and I won the state level, not the state level, I think it was the level underneath, so the division level public speaking, so inter-school public speaking competition. So then you have to represent your division to go to state level, and if you want state level, you get sent to national level. So, and then when you represent your school, because we're all under 18, we need a chaperone, so we've got a teacher who looks after us. And then I got to work with her. Her name is Miss Carol. If you're listening, Miss Carol, the good old days. We actually worked together in public speaking 2 years in a row, because I won the division level 2 years in a row, which means I got sent to state level 2 years in a row, and she was my chaperone and support teacher. And then she, because we worked together for 2 years, I think I was probably around 13 or 14, maybe 15 at a time. And then she got to hear about my upbringing and my stories. And then she said, like, you know, this is amazing that you didn't have a broken family, and you didn't have a proper family, and you didn't turn astray. Because I think that's what tend to happen in developing countries and in Asian families, is that if you have an unsuccessful family, you tend to turn out to be the rotten apple, and your future is all compromised. Because I think as children or teenager, we're still sorting things out, and I think I was probably still learning how to sort things out till like well into my 20s. So and I think that's like the critical moment that could make or break someone else's future. So I think I was quite lucky that I chose to hustle, chose to work, chose to keep busy with extracurricular activities that are meaningful, you know, rather than loitering in the shopping malls, smoking, taking up alcohol, taking drugs and stuff like that, and ruined my future. I thankfully kept myself busy to avoid that depressive thoughts and behavior with something productive. And I think I was very lucky like that, and I don't know if everyone is as lucky like that. So if you are listening to this pod and you are feeling a little lonely, you're feeling like you are carrying the weight of the world alone on your shoulder, just know that you don't have to. And just know that it's okay to talk to someone, it's okay to have a big cry, and it's okay to let your emotions out. Yeah, and I think I was, again, a very lucky person that I was just being who I am. Like, you know, obviously being a male, I think we have the stereotype that men are not supposed to show emotions, men are not supposed to be weak. But growing up gay, and I always knew that I was gay, and people around me probably always also know that I'm gay, and it became almost like acceptable because I am what people would say more feminine than a manly man. So yeah, so it kind of like, it's okay for me to have these moments of weakness, because it's almost just like me being a woman, me being princessy and being precious. Yeah, so that's one thing that people didn't know, that I actually had depression in my teenage, and yeah, in my teenage years. So that was probably from the ages of 12 all the way to just finishing up university in my like early 20s, so like 21 22, so a good 10 years when I couldn't be comfortable with my own company. And then I remember during those times I was dating, so I had boyfriends, and I think with depression, it's most of the time comes side by side with anxiety. And yeah, and I remember like when I was dating, so you would obviously text or call backwards and forwards from occasionally throughout the week to become more regular, and then to becoming, you know, almost every day. And then somehow, I guess it's because it's the first time that I was receiving such attention and such love from and care from somebody else, that I became actually quite obsessive and quite needy and quite anxious about everything. Like I would go, for example, have a shower, and I would need to bring my phone with me, and I was like, what if they text and I couldn't reply that instant? Like, I was constantly on guard, and that was bad. It got real bad as time goes on. And I remember, I remember I always had to reply in an instant, because I wanted them to know that I'm free to catch up, because I wanted them to know that I'm not busy doing other things, and I would happily reschedule myself to go on a date or to catch up, to meet up, to do whatever. Yeah. And then if I replied and then they haven't responded instantly as well, then I get into this super depressed mode. Like I would go, yeah, they don't care, they don't want me. It's so unrealistic, it's so irrational, but at the time you don't know better and you just think that that was normal. Yeah. And so it became quite disruptive into my studies in university, because I'll be constantly on guard, waiting for that text message on the phone. And then just things like that. Whether I'm in a lecture or in a tutorial, whether I'm going to, again, extracurricular activities, when I'm at work. So you become this really obsessive person, and then it got real bad. Yeah. And I think what really helped coming out of it was when I found exercise. I didn't come across, like many people will probably found the cure or the wake up call into their depression, into their mental state. I wouldn't even say it's an issue, but I would just say it's a mental state, because I feel like I, even today, sometimes can get quite depressed, can get quite down. But it's about learning how to manage it now way better than back then. So I came across exercise, and that's how I got introduced to the world of Les Mills. Les Mills is an international brand, and they are the leader in creating pre-choreographed group fitness exercise experience. They are all over the world. They started in humble Auckland, New Zealand, and now they are running the world of group fitness. So I got introduced to my very first body pump class. Body pump is a weight class. It's more about weight endurance rather than strength training. So essentially it's high amount of repetitions and using light to moderate weights. So you would do, back then it was close to about 800 reps in the whole hour class, but today you could get from anywhere from 800 to 1200 repetitions in an hour's class, and that is a lot of repetitions. Yeah, so from someone who has never touched a barbell or a weight plate before, I was anxious going to this class. I was like, what am I doing here? I'm gonna make a fool out of myself, and this is silly. I should go home now, because funnily enough, my very first class was also a crazy stupid o'clock 6 a.m. class at the university gym. Yeah, and then I came across this class. I went to the class and I got hooked. I got hooked because of the actual science that everyone has been preaching about. Exercise does make you happy. Exercise does help you, manage depression or any mental health conditions. Exercise does give you the serotonin, the adrenaline, the endorphins, all the feel-good factor in our lives, essentially, all the good hormones that we need, the feel-good hormones. So I went to this class and I just like, this is so bloody challenging, but why am I enjoying this so much? It was literally like that. And then I had to go back for more, and I just got hooked, and I just became an exercise junkie. And I think being an exercise junkie is better than being a depressed teenager or 20-year-old, to be honest. And yes, so that's how it happened. That's how I got introduced to the world of group fitness, to fitness overall, like health and fitness industry. And the rest, as they say, is history. And I think that's how I managed to come out of my depressive self, because I didn't go to the gym with anybody. Like, before I found group fitness, I was probably going to the gym with somebody because I couldn't bear the thought of going alone to be with my own company. But when we went together, I would just be at the cardio machine and do the cardio exercise for the duration that we were there. But then when I found this group fitness stuff, I was, you are such an individual, but you're also part of the group, which is what I love about the feeling of group fitness. Like, we might not all be interacting with one another, but being in a Les Mills pre-choreographed program class, whichever one that you go to, because it's exercise to music, so you're moving on the beat, you're moving in a uniform fashion, so everyone is doing the same move at exactly the same time throughout the whole class. So I think that was the very first time that I actually felt belonged. I felt like I wasn't alone anymore, and I felt like, I think that's when the light bulb started to brighten up a little bit, because I think deep down we always know, but sometimes is, you know, our thoughts are not as clear as other times. So that was when everything just became really clear that I am not alone in this world. I am part of this world. Like, and then when your muscles are burning, I remember back then in body pump, I sucked at bicep track and I suck at shoulders, and I would always feel like I want to give up halfway. And then I would look around me and then no one is giving up, and then no one is stopping, and everyone is having the same struggle, the same grunt, the same, you know, the same crease or like concentration phase, and the same amount of gusto just like flaming from inside out. And I just remember I love being part of the group, and I think that's when the whole depression thing went away. There you go. I was supposed to share 5 things that people don't know about me, and I didn't know that one thing could take so long. So there you go. This episode is entirely dedicated to the very first fact that people didn't know about me. Simon freaking Ngo was once depressed in his teenage and early 20s, and he realized that he is no longer a lone ranger in this planet because he found group fitness. That is the takeaway from this episode of the Happy Hour podcast, and I hope that you have picked up a thing or two by me sharing my story. And if you love this episode, thank you for tuning in and staying to the end of the episode. And if you love it, share it with someone you know who could benefit from this, or you know, would enjoy listening to this type of things. And please leave me a 5-star review on your podcast app, wherever you're tuning in from, because the more people who leave a positive review, the more that this pod would get or would reach a wider audience. And that's how we can keep spreading the love, keep spreading the truth, and keep reminding so many people out there that if you are ever feeling lonely and you need someone to talk to, there are many ears out there ready to listen. And if you're in Australia, there are many organizations that you can talk to. There is Headspace, Lifeline, Beyond Blue, the Black Dog Institute. And that is partially the reason why I'm such an advocate for mindset and mental health, because I was once a victim of mental health. So there you have it. The very first thing that people didn't know about me, depression. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll speak to you on the next episode about the other four things that people don't know about me.